Hi, everybody. My name is Debbie Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. It's great to be here. It's really great to be sober today. Could we please have a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years? We have that moment now. Like I say, my name is Debbie Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. I come from Rochester, New York. That's upstate New York. My home group is Monday Night Big Book. We meet Monday nights at 7 o'clock, and we are a kind of a neat Big Book meeting. What we do the first Monday of the month, we read a tradition, and then if we're done discussing the tradition, we move into the reading of the Big Book. And then in the middle Mondays, we read the Big Book solely. And then the last Monday of the month, I think we do something that is just different than any other meetings I attend, and that's we study a concept. And not many meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous study concepts. So if you ever happen to be in Rochester, New York, on the last Monday of the month, come join us. Love to have you. Okay. I do have a sponsor. Her name is Marianne, and Marianne has a sponsor, and Marianne's sponsor has a sponsor. And I'm fortunate enough to sponsor four women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That means I participate in my own recovery. I take our basic text, and I read it to them as it was read to me. And through doing that, I built a family. And I never had that before. I never had a connection in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I didn't measure up. I didn't fit in. I wasn't a part of, and I wasn't equal to. So I'm just so grateful to participate in my own recovery. The other thing that I do is currently I'm Area 47 Treatment Chair. That's my service position above the area level. In the group level, I do simple things like last week I took home the garbage, you know, and that's just the way it is, and I help facilitate our meeting. Okay. I do have a sobriety day. Don't ever want to forget it. Because of the power that's found by working the 12 steps, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol since October 22nd, 1988. And for that, I am truly grateful. My higher power thanks you. You know, I crashed and burned early, and I'm grateful you were here. One of the things I thought about before coming here is that, you know, the people sitting in this audience, you are our past, you are our present, and you are our future. So I thank you for all the service work that you've done, especially that in treatment. And I thank you for the work that you're doing currently. And I'm thanking you now for the work that you'll encourage people to pass on. So thank you for being our past, our present, and our future. I want to tell you a little bit about how I got here. I have seen people up here, and they're so calm, and I am just shaking like a leaf, and I wish I would stop. And I'm just like, okay. So I came last night, or came yesterday afternoon, and I got off the plane, and I stood by the luggage carousel, and it went around and around and around, and my luggage did not come. So, okay, it's not a big deal. You know, I have to tell you, I have a part in that. I did not get to the airport in a timely manner. Therefore, my luggage didn't arrive. Before, I would always have to blame them, you know, and that's not true today. I have a part in what happened. So I get to the hotel, and it's all dark. It's like completely black. It shut down. So a pipe burst, and it went in their electrical room. And I have to tell you, the hotel was so absolutely gracious, and they helped me with other arrangements. They were all prepared and ready, and it was absolutely fantastic. So I was only the person on the shuttle over to the next hotel, and I thought, I always get these ideas, a little alcoholic. But I stay usually at a hotel where I have a kitchen, because I'm going to be here for a week, and I like to cook and all that. So I had this idea. I asked the shuttle driver to please stop at the grocery store. So we went grocery shopping, and he pushed the cart, and he picked the items up off the shelf, and he carried the bags. Where else does that happen but in Alcoholics Anonymous? My dress arrived this morning, so I was real grateful for that. I did not want a chair and jeans, but I would have if I had to. Okay, enough about me. So I think Tom said he wanted to go first. He, like, volunteered, and he promised to leave his watch up here. Brave man. Okay. So, and this was so neat. Like, before the meeting started, we had a chance to chit-chat a little bit. And what I'm so impressed with, that every single one of our speakers had so many friends come up and say, you know, wish them well, and it's just wonderful. So without any further ado, let's head down.
Robert and Tom, I'm an alcoholic from Columbus, Ohio, and there's a group of us out here. Columbus. Not that far from Akron. Where this is. All right. It's funny, coming down on the plane on Wednesday, you know, we left and it was 70 degrees, not a cloud in the sky, and in Columbus that's an anomaly. That's unusual. You know, it's usually pretty cloudy. You usually don't need sunscreen there, and as we're flying down, you know, we are here, it's about Hurricane Alex, and, you know, we're filled with gratitude that we're flying into a hurricane, and these other people are like, are you nuts? But this is what happens when the miracle happens, you know, truly. I believe that, whether it's one-on-one or all of you. This is my first convention, so, you know, it's pretty, overload, stimulus overload, but it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. My sobriety date is October 5th of 1988, so we're pretty close. I have a home group. My home group's the Clintonville Big Book Group. We read from the Big Book, comment Tuesday nights at 8, so if you're in Columbus and you need a meeting, you can catch us there. I could say that my motive for doing any treatment facility work, and I'm privileged to also do some correctional facilities. But my motive is that I want to stay sober today. It's that simple. When we bring the meeting in, we bring a meeting into a facility called Talbot Hall, and that's affiliated with OSU hospitals. The first thing that we tell people when we sit down there is that, hi, my name, and I'm here to stay sober. And we get some funny looks because I don't want to be back there. I don't want to be back on that side. I want to be there, and I want to be able to do something about what I feel and what I see as hopelessness, despair, people that that I completely relate to, because I can be there again quickly, and I can be there quickly without drinking, too, because I've been taught that my alcoholism is a problem that centers in my mind. And so I can make all kinds of excuses to stop making those commitments, stop being here, and when I do that, I'm in trouble. I wanted to read something, and, I'm not going to read the whole big book to you, and that's a real little one, so I've got my glasses, but I want to read something to you that we open a lot of our meetings with. Our format that we bring into this particular meeting, we use the big book, we use the 12 and 12. Occasionally, we'll have somebody come in and speak, and we'll also read some from the NA book. We do not call ourselves at that particular meeting an AA meeting, and I'm not gonna beat on it, but I can tell you that the population that comes into those meetings, 80% of those people that are in there are either dually addicted or have not had much alcohol exposure at all. Although it's interesting, when we ask the question, how many would drink to get drunk, how many would substitute booze for your so-called drug of choice, most of the hands go up. So, but what we feel like doing is trying to relate to them, because, and I'll get to that in a second, but one of my favorite chapters with them is more about alcoholism, because it cuts to the chase, you know. And it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. And it goes on to explain what our disease does to us. We read that a lot, and we try to get the participation of the clients at the treatment center, or the people in the treatment center, to share a little bit about what it was like for them, and what it was like for them not, what they took the day before, what got them in for the fifth time. Because we see a lot of returners. We see a lot of people that feel like, hope is found in the hospital. And, God bless hospitals, and God bless the ability to detox somebody. But they're going to have to leave there. And when they have to leave there, they're going to find sobriety in the streets. That's where I found sobriety. and if they're willing, and if they follow a few simple directions, like is spoken in the big book. What we do with them is try to get them to see the progression a little bit. And for those that aren't nodding off, because they're all medicated, we don't care if they snore. You know, we only care if they fall off their chairs. And that has happened before. But sometimes it can be kind of comical, sadly comical. But what we try to do is have them, you'll see a little light come on, maybe, gosh, this has been my fourth time in here, and they start talking about, I started drinking and using when I was 15, and then this happened, this, and it's like, oh my God, I'm doomed. And then we say, no, you're not, because then we share a little bit about our past with them, and I'm sure there's a lot of miracles in this room, and I know I'm one, not just because I'm standing up here, but because I'm alive, period, for the things that I put my body through and everyone around me that loved me through. It's amazing that I am alive. So we have a big book, and, we do some various readings. And probably, more importantly, what we try to do, and it's officially called Bridging the Gap, is we try to set them up with numbers, people, contacts, so that they can transition. The difficult thing about the center that we're working in right now is that a lot of these folks are not in Columbus. They're on the outskirts, and there are very few meetings there. The only thing you can say is, they're going to any lengths. Somebody mentioned it earlier in another meeting, but they're going to any lengths to find, their so-called drink or drug of choice. They're going to any lengths to find that. They need to be as willing to do that. But I have a good friend that said that you'll never get that unless you have the gift of desperation. And when he first said this gift of desperation, those two things, gift and desperation, don't seem like they fit together. It's only if you become convinced through that desperation that the best way of your thinking and living and is not going to work, and becoming convinced that this does. There's two sides of that, and that right there is the essence of will they stick around or won't they stick around, or will I stick around or won't I? I need to be convinced every day I get up that there's a substitute for the way I was drinking and using. That there's a substitute for that. That is going to give me a happy and fulfilling life. And most people in there want that. There's no doubt about it. Most people in there, to a person, as they share and as they go around, they are either in there for loved ones, for their children, but anyone but them. They're there because they don't really have any self-love. And I can completely relate to that because, it got to the point where I was having so much fun that, do a couple more bottles of JD because that would kill the pain permanently. Do a couple more of these because that would, that was the lack of self-love I had. They say in here that fluffy emotional appeal will not suffice, and it won't. I can't just put my arm around and say it'll be okay, There's work involved. You're responsible for your recovery if you make that choice. But it's a heck of a lot easier to make that choice and be able to have somebody to meet them when they get out. Most people that we talk to have family members that are extremely concerned about them, wish them well. But behind them is that world of ignorance. Behind them is, this is a deal of willpower. If you had your willpower together, you wouldn't be back in that place again. And I can see it in their eyes, and I can see it in their manner that, they don't want to be back there again. As a matter of fact, that's one of the last things they say is, I hope I never have to come back here again. And my thinking behind me and, being the alcoholic I am is that, if you keep going the way you are, don't worry, you won't make it back here. That's a sad thing, too, is, we see a lot of people that have been, repeaters, and then they don't make it back. Hey, did you hear what happened to so-and-so? But somehow this level of denial, it's a difficult thing, and it just takes constant attention, and it takes our attention. They're the person that may come into your meeting, and they're the person that's going to be in the furthest corner of the room. And you may be around for quite a while, and you may have a group of friends that you're very close to, but that's the individual that needs to be approached. I know my first meetings, you know, I went to the furthest corner, I crossed my arms, and I looked at you, and I said, I dare you to come up to me. And as soon as I left that meeting, I said, that was the most miserable meeting I've ever been to, because nobody came up to me. Nobody loves me. But, you know, they're living in a very sick world, you know, whether they admit it or not. So I would say, you know, the other thing is trying to stay close to the literature. Trying to reinforce that that their recovery is going to be outside of that hospital, but not cooperating with the hospital. And that's something I wanted to mention, that, you know, we're in their house. No matter what hospital, no matter what institution it is, you know, we're there to cooperate. We may not be affiliated, but we're there to cooperate with them. And I can share a couple of experiences. We had this same hospital was once owned by another corporation, and there were no badges required. We had 16 volunteers running in and out of there. It was wonderful. I mean, it was like, you know, hey, yeah, I can't go this week, or, you know, I mean, we were just actually made us lazy is what it really did. But we were always covered. The shifts were always covered. And when that hospital became OSU, they said, well, you have to get ID badges. Well, our number went from 16 to 2. I'm not doing what they want us to do. I'm not going to do that. Well, that's fine. Bottom line is, I'm the one that enhances. I'm the one that benefits from it, you know. And it's a wonderful indescribable. For those of all of you that are involved in service, you'll know that feeling. I don't care what problem I ever brought into there. It's gone when I leave there. And it only takes an hour. And it's free. But it's amazing. There's been another facility that we approached. They're interested in having some treatment meetings. And they said, now this is our format, and this is how we want you to operate it, and we're going to have the patients run this meeting. And we said, no, thank you. So there's the other side of it, too. There's the other side of that coin. But being cooperative is always important with the facility. They love it when we come in. Some of the times I think they love it when we come in because it's really, really chaotic up there. And, you know, we give them a break, you know, for a short time. But, you know, sometimes they'll come in and there's a lot of meds being distributed. You know, I have my own opinions about that, but there's an awful lot of medications being distributed, and sometimes those get distributed right during the meeting. And I know that the old me would have let them know that's exactly how rude that was. But you know what? It is what it is. You know, it is what it is with that. So I think cooperating with the facility is extremely important. But, you know, I guess the real bottom line is no matter what we say in there, no matter what kind of message that we're bringing in to that particular treatment facility, is that we make sure that all those folks have an opportunity of some type to have connections when they leave. That is really, really critical. We ask them, you know, what are you going to do afterwards? After they share a little bit about what it's like for them, you say, what are you going to do afterwards? Well, you know, I'm going to go home and my father's going to take care of me. I'm going to go home and, you know, I'm going to do it for my kids. You know, they desperately want to be well. They just don't know how to get there yet. You know, and a lot of them are getting younger and younger. And there was a treatment facilities meeting earlier today, and it's not uncommon to see 16-year-old girls in there with two kids. That's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to have the majority of them in that room under 20 years old. And then occasionally you'll have the old beat-up drunk in the corner, you know, like me or somebody that's been there, you know, and it's obvious what he's there for. But maybe he's there just to have a little vacation or something. I don't know. But, you know, it's heartbreaking. They talk about being on the firing line. That's truly on the firing line. I like to be on the firing line. I get a lot back from being that way on the firing line. And in your communities, you know, if you have an opportunity to help, whether you bring a meeting in or whether you can hook up with somebody that comes to your home group, you know, that could save a life. So with that, I think I'm burning my time. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate your share. Next, we have Pamela.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pamela, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so nervous I cut myself shaving this morning. Here. I hate people that come up to these podiums with it written down, because I've always liked it when people share from the heart. But I knew I would just go blank, so I wrote it down from the heart. I hope you'll bear with me. I'd like to thank Rick W. and Debbie and the committee that asked me to share here today. I'd like to thank them, but if I don't puke after about 15 minutes, I will thank them. On May 24th, 2010, I celebrated 20 years of new life in this beautiful program. And I thought, what better way to commemorate it than by attending my very first AA convention? You see, as a result of my sobriety, my husband and I have four beautiful daughters who have never seen me drink. But I was too busy raising them to get to any conventions until this year. So now, on the very brink of becoming a first-time grandmother, the baby's due on the 10th of July, I'm thrilled to be here in San Antonio with all of you. Just thrilled. Yeah. I was supposed to talk to you about treatment facilities from my point of view, so I'll tell you that the first time I was in a treatment center, I was 3 weeks sober, and I was 3 weeks pregnant, although I didn't know that at the time. And both of those things were like miracles, because by the time I quit drinking, I was having a hard time staying sober for 3 hours. And all the doctors had told me that I'd never have children. Never tell an alcoholic what to do. I had four of them. And at the detox in Calgary, they told me that my chances of recovery improved if I attended a 28-day treatment program, and that even then, only 2% of the people in treatment with me would get well. I wanted to be one of those 2%. I completed the program, and I learned that I should get into AA and stay there if I wanted to hang on to my sobriety. That was probably the biggest thing I learned there. I moved to Winnipeg, and I was 3 months sober when I next went to a center with my sponsor when she took the meeting there. I'll always remember that newly sober woman that we were speaking with. She looked up at me, and I looked so good. You know, I had my belly, and I had shine in my eye. And she thought she could never attain what I had. She said, "How could I ever get what you have?" And I said, "I've only been sober 3 months." There was a real transformation in me already. After I had my baby, we moved back to Dauphin to be with my husband, who's here for the first time. I've never spoken in front of him before. I think that's why I'm so nervous. He doesn't know this about me. And I involved myself deeply in my group there. I saw that many of the women that I sponsored had come into AA after treatment. And in today's society, treatment often occurred after the 12-step call. Before the 12-step call, I mean. But it wasn't until my youngest was in school that I got involved in service. While serving my terms as AGSR and GSR and DCM, I began to learn about the group conscience always being right, because God speaks to us through the group. I thought my group mistook my enthusiasm for bossiness, actually. I was just being enthusiastic. But I had so many bright ideas that they didn't want any part of. Anyway, I learned in spite of myself, and then last October I let my name stand for Treatments West. And since I was the only one who did, I got in by a landslide. I saw myself as being the connection between the treatment facility personnel and the coordinator of the AA group. But I soon realized that there was no active committee, no official coordinators. Furthermore, most of the AA contact numbers that I had for Northern Manitoba were obsolete. And I began to appreciate the unique challenge of trying to chair this committee. Manitoba has 250,000 square miles. And to give you an idea of the size of that, Texas has 268,000 square miles. We all know how big Texas is, right? My territory encompasses Willard Munson House in St. Rose de Lac, a mere 45 minutes from where I live in Dauphin, Parkwood in Brandon, a couple hours away, a center in the Paw run by the RHA that's about 5 hours away, and then Polaris House in Thompson that's 9 hours from home. I had a budget of $400 for the year, and I could foresee this being a problem. Fortunately for me, both Corrections West and PIPCPS, and you know the initials one, West chairs, service chairs, also live in Dauphin. And we decided to team up and travel together to cut costs. We arranged the times and dates for St. Rose and Brandon and held presentations there, gained contact lists, and began to form a committee. While in St. Rose, I heard from the clients about an awesome new meeting they had attended the night before via teleconferencing. I don't know if you guys have that here, but last November it was brand new in Manitoba, and it was just starting. And they were very excited about it because they had attended a meeting with Thompson, Lynn Lake, Cross Lake, and a couple of other very remote nursing stations, places that heretofore had no AA groups. Of course, many of the clients from the Western Treatment Facilities are from remote areas. And when they are released from the center and go home, there is no AA group. It usually doesn't take very long before they're back in the problem. So these teleconferencing meetings can be set up in hospitals, nursing stations, treatment centers, and clients can attend them while they're in treatment so that they know what to do when they get home. They know where to go. And sometimes more than one newcomer attends at that place, and they meet, and a new group is born. It's kind of neat. They seem to be a beacon of AA light in the dark north. I attended several of these meetings, and the feeling of connection over the vast distance was awe-inspiring. Sometimes a place like Thompson or Selkirk or St. Rose, there would be 7 or 10 people at the table with the camera on you. And then in Cross Lake or Lynn Lake, it'd be one person. You knew that if that camera wasn't there, they wouldn't be getting the meeting. It really made me appreciate my home group. Anyway, over the next couple of months, I ferreted out phone numbers and email addresses and planned the northern trip for May 1st. Since I estimated the cost of the trip to be around $1,000, I enlisted the cooperation of our area delegate and area chair, who are also planning a trip to the remote north, so we hitchhiked along with them. Although this wasn't my first trip to Thompson, it never fails to amaze me how after the 53rd parallel, the trees get smaller and scrubbier until by the time you get to Flin Flon, you have a town built on rock where even the plumbing pipes are above ground. It's kind of wild. 9 hours on the road calls for a lot of fellowship, and we were up to the challenge. We got to know each other a lot better. Some of those people said they know more about home births than they ever thought they wanted to. The trip was hugely exciting, as it is simply a 12-step call to the north. And we were welcomed wholeheartedly by professionals and AAs alike. Even in Dauphin, we're secluded enough that when out-of-towners attend our meeting, it's a real treat to hear someone other than ourselves talk. And this certainly seems to be the case up north, where they handed over their meetings to us and freely and actively participated in the discussions. And we obtained volunteers and phone numbers for contact. It was a rousing success story. Of course, by the time I phoned all my brand new contacts for the report to the assembly, too, about a month and a half later, half of them had other commitments and then had to resign. So kind of in a position of chairing a committee that only exists when I'm in that town. So why would I be planning on making another trip there next spring? Because Bill says that the newcomer is the lifeblood of our program and the main reason for our existence. I see my job as being the connection between treatment and AA. Treatment is where we get our new people. Sponsorship is the key to AA's future at all levels of service. We have to give it away or else we lose what we have been so freely given. Without my sponsor getting on my tail about doing the steps, chairing meetings, getting into general service, I doubt I could have maintained any kind of meaningful sobriety. Without getting into service, I may have maintained my sobriety, but I would never have accessed the level of spirituality that being active in service requires of me, for sure. I love AA, and it comes first in my life, before my children, before my husband, before myself, because I can see clearly that without it, soon I would lose all of those things that I hold so dear. I always tell my pigeons, or sponsees as they call them now, that if they put AA first, they will always have time for all the things that life puts in their path. But if they do all of those other things first, they won't even have time for a meeting. I love AA, and when you love something, you want to take care of it and nurture it and make sure it's there for the next desperate case that comes along. And there's so many of us yet to make it here. Who knows? Maybe my own daughters may need us someday. And I want to do my part to ensure that the doors will always be open. I see that we must foster goodwill with professionals and create greater clarity about our traditions and guidelines and use these tools to work among other alcoholics in a changing world. For example, teleconferencing and multi-addictions. In today's world, treatment is strongly endorsed by the government, the workplace, and our society as a whole. Movies are made about people attending treatment and getting sober. Our job is to be there when the alcoholic gets out of treatment. In the end, I get far more from anything I do for AA than I could ever repay. I have been introduced into a way of life that enables me to meet new people every week and watch them change from desperate, bewildered drunks to contented and useful members of society. And I can be a part of that because I have been where they are. My biggest flaw has become my greatest gift. Thank you.
Is that not the language of the heart? Great, thank you so much. We have one more speaker, and this afternoon, I give you Brett.
And how do I follow that? That was that was absolutely wonderful, both of you guys. I am Brett, alcoholic. And now I'm going to cry. I have to tell you, there was a speaker who, a long time, my first year of sobriety, a person gave me all these speaker tapes, and one of the guys said, just wait till you're so grateful you can't see. And that's been my experience through this weekend. You know, there's so much good energy and so much recovery and love and just, I don't know. We were doing some volunteer work, my husband and my little one-year-old and I at the Alamo yesterday, and it was raining and it was sloshy and it was terrible, but it was so much fun. I mean, it's like you just saw all of us little drunks running around, you know, and like we've never, like we're... You know, that's that camaraderie they talk about, the steerage to the captain's table. You know, we're all the same, and yet our stories are a little bit different, yada, yada. Anyway, so I'm a baby. My sobriety date is 11/4/04, so I'm 5. When I got the letter to be able to do this, I was like, what? I haven't done a treatment. I haven't taken a meeting into a treatment center since my baby was born about a year ago. And then I talked to my service sponsor. I have two sponsors. I have a sponsor and then I have a service sponsor. And even though I'm not a service anymore at the time, because when I had my baby, I kind of slowed down my life and reprioritized. But I've been in every part of treatment. You know, I'm here. So what I'm going to share with you is my experience, strength, and hope. And also, because I was asked to do this, I actually got my bottoming gear and started doing a monthly meeting. My passion is drug court. I got here through the court system. I did not want to be sober. I sat here for the first six months of my sobriety hating every one of you. I knew you were lying, and I didn't think that you could be sober. I mean, who in that stupid look in your eyes? I mean, really. And it was gross. So I sat around. I sat around waiting for you guys to screw up so I could go do my thing. And you haven't yet, so I'm still waiting. Anyway, so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, about 8 years ago for the first time, and I sat around a meeting, still doing other things. Because I thought alcohol might be my problem. I talked to a friend of mine, and I said, I don't know if alcohol is really my problem. And she said, normal people don't worry about that. And so so I chose to go drink, and I drank for a few more years. And, it says in the big book, gradually things got worse, and it wasn't gradual. Once I got my first DUI, it was like DUI, DUI, jail. And I ended up in drug court. And what I knew is that two people that were way worse than me, which were probably all the same, they got sober through the court system. But it wasn't through the court system. What happened is the consequences of the court system made me do the things that keep me sober today. So I went to drug court. I swore into drug court, and then I couldn't get sober. And it was I had a lot of problems, a lot of things. And because of good sponsorship, I only share about certain ones in closed meetings. I only share about alcoholism in closed meetings. But I am the person that needed the sponsorship and the good big book-based meetings to inform me what my problem is. Because I thought if I'm a drug addict, I can go and drink. You know, and I tried that right after rehab, and it didn't work very well. But so I got in drug court. I couldn't be sober. I'd never been sober. I started drinking at 11, and so they kept throwing me in jail, and finally they just put me in jail and wouldn't let me out. And I went to a drug pod because they said that would look good, and I wouldn't have to really do my prison time maybe. And I sat in meetings, and I hated the people that brought the meetings in. One, the people that brought the meetings in didn't look like I felt. You know, they were clean, and they weren't bruised up. You know, they just didn't look like I felt. But I heard stuff. You know, we went because it was kind of the social hour, and you could get out of your pod. And some people may know that. But I heard things, and like there was one girl who will always be part of my life who said that we have a disease that tells us we don't have a disease. You know, and to today, that is something that I have to remember. I am as close to a drink today as I was 5 years ago, you know. So I sat there, and I was this early angry person who really didn't want to be there, but things sunk in. I got out of jail. I went to a 45-day treatment program where I was this early person. I colored while they brought AA meetings in. But one of the things that I heard through a person coming and sharing his experience, Strength and Hope, is that a lot of things can fit inside of a bottle. You know, I'm a low bottom drunk. I lost absolutely everything, but I had no idea, you know. So I got out of treatment. I went to a casino and I drank, and then I got sentenced to sober living, and I lived in sober living. And the sober living that I lived in was based on the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which for me was absolutely crucial. We had to go to meetings, and we went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of meetings mainly because I didn't want to be in a house with 9 women. And that was like an hour of freedom. And so I went to a lot of meetings, and, you know, I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, everybody. And we have really good AA. We're really blessed. I've been a national color educator in since I've been sober, and I've got to go to different cities and check out meetings. And I really love our AA. I love AA. Period. Actually, so I lived in sober living, and my first week in sobriety, my first month in sobriety, I didn't want to be sober. I wanted to get the judge off my back, and I was going to stay sober maybe for a year, and then I would go drink or do whatever. I think I was going to go to Europe, which no idea where that came from. But so my first month sober, I was told to go to be of service, to go take meetings into detox, to go take meetings into wherever, just get out of my head, because my head is the most dangerous place, you know. So that's what I did. I mean, I'm from a strong... I have two groups. One is about love, and it's grown me into the woman that I am. And the other one was a traditional meeting that taught me the strong fundamental principles of the traditions. And I'm grateful for both of those because I love my life. So I started taking meetings into detoxes, into 12 and 12, into which is an inpatient rehab, into pretty much anywhere that we could do it. And I saw people that were like me, and it was wonderful. Where my connection is, about a year after that, and I've stayed in service in one way or another, one capacity or another, throughout my sobriety. Where my passion is, it's the between the drug court. I graduated drug court in 2005, and we have some areas where, I don't know how to say it. I won't say it. What we're doing right now in Tulsa is we go into one of the rehabs and we do an informational orientation meeting that explains what AA is and what AA isn't. For the people that are like me who came into Alcoholics Anonymous and who have multiple things going on, because I did. And if I would have not been told the message that's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I have a mental obsession coupled with a phenomenon of craving, I would be dead. You know, that when I put alcohol into my system, I don't stop. I don't know whose ceiling fan I'm going to be looking at the next day. You know, I can't control myself. So without that strong message and good sponsorship. So what we're doing there is trying to create an orientation meeting, which has been pretty neat. I mean, it's seeing me just angry, pissed off drug court people who don't think they have a problem and they really aren't looking for a solution, but they're going to do it for a little bit. And so when I got asked to do this, sorry, I'm kind of coming into play. I went to a central service, which is where we get our pamphlets and stuff. And I got one over, the traditions, you know, because I was going to be like super AA girl at the international. And somebody said, you know, breathe and just let God do it. Which is always good advice. But what I did do is I read the one on treatment centers, which was really cool. There were three things that I got out of it that I hadn't read. One of them is it talks about being flexible. And, you know, I've done a lot of different meetings at a lot of different treatment centers, and I think one of my favorites is where the people in the meeting would write down the questions they had, and everybody would pull it out of this box, and you would tell your experience on that question. And so they really got the information that you wanted. I like the one that I'm doing right now because I think it's important. I think it's valid. It's fun. It's okay. But it's more important than it is fun. They talk about being a good example to the treatment facilities because we may be the only person that is actually, they see an AA. You know, if I tell them a time to be there, I need to be there on time. I need to be a walking big book. I need to think outside of myself to not take on commitments that I can't do. Which is why in the last year I haven't taken on any commitments because I have a one-year-old, you know. It's to honor the gift that's been given each and every one of us. What was the other thing? I wanted to write it down. I totally did. There was something else. I called the drug court, the judge at drug court, and asked her if she was talking to AA, what would she say, her and my old probation officer, because I kind of wanted to hear what non-alcoholics are thinking. And they said to give us a big thank you, you know, because without us, the work they do is for nothing. They don't stay sober. We don't stay sober without a program that gives us solution, you know, and that's what AA is. So drug court was great for getting me here, but it's my job to honor AA and the gift that's been given to me as much as possible. And then I talked to a couple of elder statesmen or bleeding deacons. It depends on which side you sit on. I love them. I love them both. And they were talking about how it's important for us to have a strong basis in what we're giving. You know, like when I take that meeting in, I need to know that the message I'm giving is the true message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we need to stay towards the traditions, like not bringing up religion, you know, things like that. And I thought that was really interesting. I talked to somebody else who said that they can tell when we're actually working the program because something happens in our faces and they don't know what it is. And we see that. We see that here. So in closing, I think that, I don't know, it's great to imagine me on that first day that I came in. And if you guys think about the first day that you came in, you know, and look at the differences in who we are. I mean, we can't do that ourselves. It's something so much bigger than us. And it's so important for me to stay in touch with who I was and who I'm capable of being because I'm only a drink away from it at any given time. So, thank you.
Well, I'd just like to thank our three panelists once again. I think they've done an awesome job. We have a bit of time left, and so we have choices. And if anybody is comfortable and would like to, you are more than welcome to come to the center mic. You can bring up a topic. You can share a little bit of your own experience. Or if you're ready to close, you let me know. Okay. They are running. Okay. Go ahead.
I don't want to close. And it's all about me. My name is Joe Marks. I am an alcoholic. I'm from Morganton, North Carolina. My home group is the Valdez Discussion Group on Wednesday nights in Valdez, North Carolina. I keep wanting to say North Dakota because a good friend of mine says that I sound like I'm from Fargo. I spent a lot of time in Minneapolis, St. Paul. God has put in my life a new work environment, and then I'm responsible for a halfway house and also a transitional home for homeless men. And when you talk about sponsorship, that's critical. And you talk about bridging the gap, that's critical. You talk about being the committee of one, that's exactly what you are. And one of the things, and I'm asking for ideas, I've seen people and men at both these homes that get sponsors go on and get the program, and move on in their life. Those people who don't do that are back in drug court. And so I agree that it's really critical. Every meeting that I go to, I ask for help in saying that here's a situation. You know, I'm looking for people who would be temporary sponsors or whatever. So I'm really looking for ideas and some help on how to get the community excited about helping us at those homes. So
that's all I got.
Thank you.
My name is Doug. I'm an alcoholic. My home group's Bristol Group in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and thanks to the panel for being here. I've heard a lot of useful things. I'm real fortunate. I'm helping out with the corrections committee in my district, and I talk to a lot of young people who don't have an alcohol problem. Now, they've got a drug problem, and they said, whichever one of you said, I've heard them say, I don't have a drinking problem. I don't know why. I just can't go out and smoke pot. I have a problem with crack and whatever. Now, I've got that on one side, and on the other hand, I've got a lot of the old-timers. I got sober with the old-timers, and I've caught myself saying this and thinking this over the years, and it's starting to change now, but I can't relate to you. Now, an example of a drug person, now a tweaker over here who tells me that he's having thoughts of relapsing when he smells a hot manifold on a six-cylinder. It makes him think of crack cocaine. I don't know what that means. And then I know that in the 80s, I did every drug that there was then. But you know what? When they didn't have it, I didn't miss it. You know, where I could not drink. So I don't know how to talk to the men that I'm talking. And they are men at 18, 20, 25 years old. So how do I tell them? And one of the more profound things that came to me during these meetings of why I like corrections meetings, and I don't dislike the other ones, I'm just saying I like these a lot, is these fellas don't talk about their day. There's not one mention of their day. They're wanting solutions, and they're asking questions like, if I know that I'm going to get in trouble drinking, why do I want to? So what do we tell them? That's my question. Thanks.
Can I just maybe address that question a little bit? I think our basic text does an awesome job of that. On page 25, it says there is a solution. Hardly any of us like it. It's in the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the admission of our shortcomings, that the process requires for its successful consummation. When I had been approached by others in whom the problem had been solved, I had nothing left to do but pick up the kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet. You know, I had a choice to accept spiritual help and follow the 12 steps, or I can go to the bitter end and end up in jail or death. So what do we tell them? We tell them the truth. We tell them we have a solution in Alcoholics Anonymous, which we can agree upon. And it's worked for the past 75 years. That's what we tell them. Thanks. Next.
I'd like to address and join the fellow that bridging the gap is a really tough thing. I'm Susan Robinson. I'm in Area 54, which is Northeast Ohio, and I am treatment facilities chair, and with that goes bridging the gap. They can almost, and now they're trying to put special needs on top of it. My God. Anyway, sorry, that just slipped. Bridging the gap, I think, is our 12-step work, and I think the message that we have to give back to through our GSRs, back to the groups, and also to GSO, is that this is the 12-step work that And in my area, I'm really fortunate. There are a couple of intergroups who have picked it up. All I have to do is email the people coming out of my treatment center that I get the most requests from into, say, Youngstown, Akron, Lorain. They're right on it. They're right on it. Unfortunately, our largest city doesn't think it's part of their business. And it's a whole new thing, and we whole new orientation of brain. And this can't be a better place to talk about it. So if all of you will put Bridging the Gap, how does this man, first off, his district needs to take him on as a project. And the district, his district where he's with this homeless group, should be able to start the process of helping him with Bridging the Gap. He should not be alone. General Service gives us people. And that's how I think that it's supposed to work. Not that I'm very successful at it, but I'm sure trying. And so I'm encouraging you to continue trying, and I'm encouraging him to go to his area group and to his district for help.
Thank you. Somebody else?
Hello, I'm Jim from San Antonio with, welcome y'all. I have 183 days of sobriety. Chaired my first home group meeting today. Kind of cool. And the thing I enjoy the most in this program is the treatment facility that I go to on Monday nights. And I don't know why. But they tell me, the people in those facilities, that they really enjoy us new people in the program because they can relate and, wow, how did you get 180 days? You know, and they really appreciate that. So those of you with a lot of experience in this program, to encourage us, because we get an awful lot out of it, and I hope that the clients in those facilities do too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Bruce, an alcoholic.
Hi, Bruce.
And, wow, staying in front of this mic is funky. Anyways, I'm treatment and corrections chair up in Putnam County, New York. And, I'm a member of Bridging Gap, even though they haven't mailed me anything yet. So, because it is done by mail by us. Anyways, I just want to say, I was listening to him, and one of the things he said, when somebody comes back, for the fifth time, and when we walk into those treatment centers and we bring a meeting, sometimes I feel right at home. Because if I had only done 15 rehabs, I wouldn't bother with AA. If I had only been arrested 30 times, I wouldn't have a problem. And God, if I only had 4 DWIs, I'd think I was normal. So, and that's the thing. When we walk in there, we got to remember what's said in the big book. And doctor's opinion is pretty much wrapped up into, we have no idea of what reality really is the day we walk in here. We have no idea. We think we do. You ask me, I would have told you, my mom, I was 40 years old. My mom's my problem. I remember my sponsor saying, what did she do to you? I don't remember. It was about 30 years ago. Don't you think you should let that go? And so many other things. And we have an answer for everything when we walk in, and we just got to listen to them. And we got to remember, and we hear that, and we just remember that terminal uniqueness. And I was just looking straight in the eye and said, that was terminally unique, too. And that's why I went back to jail again and again. And when we walk in there, we just call on our history, for that is our greatest asset. It really is our greatest asset when we walk in there. And we just talk to them naturally. And me, I'm a little bit hardcore, because that's how I got it. When my sponsor looked at me and I started talking to him, I think, and he said, no. He said, whatever you're thinking is wrong. I said, how do you know what I'm thinking? He said, I don't care. If you like the shirt I'm wearing, I would go home and change it. All right. And, I got it hardcore, and, I give it hardcore, and that's okay. But, when we really rely on our experiences, when I walk into Valhalla Prison, and I talked to the guys in the prison. For me, not everybody can do this. I point at the table where I got into the arguments. I point to where I used to work out, where all of us used to work out, and they ID with it. And sometimes we just have to relate to the fact that We all drank. We got arrested. We did not walk in here for the coffee, you know? Okay? And we just have to go to our history. And just I rely on my fourth step because it's there. So thank you. And thank you for a great meeting.
Gentlemen, white T-shirt. Gentlemen, white T-shirt, you wanted to speak?
Sure. My name's Peter. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pete.
It's truly by the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am sober and free from alcohol. My home group is the HAL group in El Paso, Texas, and my sobriety date is February 19th, 1994. For that, I'm grateful and want to thank you people. I was listening to what this gentleman was talking about. When I take meetings, I've been doing this, carry the message behind the walls, El Paso County Jail. It's the annex. And I guess my sponsor saw it fit for me to do this. He said that I needed to get more into service. And he recommended that I do this jail thing. And I said, there's no way in the world. They won't let me in. And he looked at me and says, have you tried? I said, no, I haven't. Anyhow, I was able to get in by the grace of God. And what happened was when these people asked me questions and, you know, I carried the message. My only set of tools is the little big books that I'm allowed to take into. And that's the tool that I take in there. And the hope that I give these guys, because there are guys signing for now, DWIs I guess are pretty harsh on, and you know, they're signing for 10, 20, you know, 25 years. But they're still sitting in these meetings. They've been going to meetings for years and years, or at least three. Anyhow, the hope that I give them is, I tell them simply this. I've sat where you sit, maybe in a different color, but the hope that I want to give you if you want to stay clean and sober and live a decent life is, you know, you can sit where I sit, because I used to go to meetings when I was locked up and incarcerated, and yeah, it was to get out of the pod for an hour or, you know, maybe some donuts, what have you. But the hope that I give them is, you know, and if you've been incarcerated and you've never done service work, you know, and you don't have to have been incarcerated, but it just helps that if we've done time and they see you where you're at today, you know, it just helps. And I get these letters, like the first letter I got from this one guy, it was amazing. You know, he has signed for a 7-year deal, and I got a letter and my wife read it and I was like, wow. And I continue to get these letters. And, you know, they're helping me a lot, hell of a lot more than I'm helping them. But the hope that I want to give them is they can also chair a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Jesse Tuck. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Jesse.
I'd like to thank the panel once again. I find myself in a dilemma this time. I've carried meetings to treatment centers, forensic units, jails. And for anybody who wants to volunteer to go to jail and you get turned down from a facility, apply at a different facility, because there's some facilities I could go to, some I could not. My dilemma now, though, is I'm currently employed by a treatment center. And being an alcoholic and an addict, I feel like I have to walk a tightrope sometimes, being on the professional side of the industry that I've never been in before. And I don't know if anybody's had that or is going through that. I feel if this is the place to ask. Somebody's gone through it before, and somebody has some ideas of how to somewhat disassociate, I guess is what I'm looking for. I don't know how to do it. I'm having a hard time. I feel like I'm walking a tightrope all the time. I haven't been scolded harshly yet, but sometimes I'm an alcoholic and addict first and foremost, and I share with the clients. And, I have to watch what I share from time to time because I'm an alcoholic and addict. I sometimes forget that I am actually staff. So if anybody has any corners, I'd be glad to hear them. Thank you.
My name is Roger. I'm an alcoholic.
Roger.
From Santa Rosa, California, the South Park Survivors Group. By the grace of God, I've been sober since March 12, 1973. And I've worked almost all those years in treatment. And I have, they used to put out a pamphlet called Two Hatters. I don't know if they do that anymore, but I have always had a principle. I don't care if you know what I do. All I want you to know when I come to these programs is I want to stay clean and sober, and I'll do what I have to do that. And if I worked in a bank, I wouldn't be going around telling you what I do for a living. It's not important. And what I do in the treatment center, and I'm retired, but I still work a couple of days a week just for the hell of it. Wife says it keeps me off the streets. But anyway, I'm sure that about half the people in my home group have no idea what I do or what I've ever done. And I've really had a wonderful career in the field, and it was just really important for me to keep it separate from my AA life.
Thank you. Ladies before gentlemen.
I'm Janet, and I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. Oh, you can't hear me. I'm Janet Richards, and I'm an alcoholic.
Janet.
And I'm the treatment facilities chair for Area 1 in Alabama and Northwest Florida. And my home group is the Pelham Group in Birmingham, Alabama. And we've gotten involved with the Bridging the Gap. We've just elected someone in Area 1 to be the Bridging the Gap coordinator. But we've been trying to coordinate that, and it's a lot of work, but it's very rewarding, and it's very important, I think, to have a temporary contact for people coming out of treatment. So in our district in Birmingham, I developed a pamphlet for the client in treatment and had it approved, you know, went and had it approved at our district meeting, and it explains what Bridging the Gap does, that it's a temporary contact program, that they'll have someone, an AA member, will carry them to a couple of meetings, introduce them to the literature, get them some phone numbers, familiarize them with the literature, you know, the books, and get them a meeting schedule. And if they're interested, to sign up and has a place for their discharge date. And so we pass that out at the treatment facilities during the AA meeting, only to people that are interested because it's expensive to make copies. And then we have a sheet that I mailed out to all the groups that explains what Bridging the Gap does. And if you're interested, to sign up with your name and phone number. Because, you know, Birmingham's a pretty big city, and someone, we try to get an AA member that's in the same area as the person coming out of treatment, where they live in the same area, so it's not so far for them to drive. And that's worked really well. I put my name and address at the bottom, so they just mail the sheets back to me from the different groups. We have like 60 groups in Birmingham, and I probably have at least 30 groups that have returned these forms, and they, you know, at least four or five members have signed up. So that's really helped to aid with the whole Bridging the Gap contact program. And the only other thing I wanted to say was that the reason I'm so interested in treatment and carrying the message into treatment facilities is I've been in 14 treatment centers. And the last one I was in, someone came in, and I actually remembered them and recognized them, and they were still sober. And the hope that that gave me, you know, just it really made a huge difference, and because I had become hopeless. And by seeing them, it gave me just that small bit of hope that I, too, could recover. And so it's real important to me to go back and to, you know, to go back into treatment facilities and to be there for the next person. And I thank y'all for your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your service. We have time for maybe two or three more.
Hi, my name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
And I'm truly grateful to be able to live and sober today. I am currently the treatment chair for our district. I'm from Decatur, Illinois, and my home group is the Monday Night Mustard Seed in Decatur, Illinois. And, you know, what we do is we plan. I get to be of service to that group by planning the meetings for, you know, we have a meeting on Monday night and we have a meeting on Wednesday night that we carry into the treatment center. And we only have one treatment center in our district, so that's really not that difficult, and it's really not that big of a deal to try and find volunteers to go do that. I personally chair the Wednesday night meeting, so there's only one meeting that, you know, we need to have volunteers to go in and chair that meeting, you know, four times a month. But, you know, I also get the opportunity to be, you know, work with a recovering home, and, you know, I get to assist in that, and, there's a chapter level to that recovery home, and I was in a different house in that chapter, you know, when I first got sober. But, you know, some of the things that we try to do for our treatment center and the people inside the treatment center is, you know, we encourage the treatment center to bring the, you know, the residents to outside meetings. And, you know, I know my home group, they come to our home group on Monday nights because we have speaker meetings that night on the last Monday of the month. And we make out names and phone number list for each individual that comes into that meeting. And it just, you know, it helps out so much. And, you know, it's like some of the other people said, the treatment center that I go in and I chair the meetings at is probably one of the best meetings that I'm actually able to go to, because I get so much more out of it than they get out of it. And, you know, I would encourage anybody to, you know, encourage their young people in their communities to get involved and do service work for their community and for their, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, because service work's what, you know, really helps me stay involved and get out of myself, because I'm a very shy and timid person anyways. And so, you know, even to come up here and say hello to you guys, like, no, I don't want to do that. But, you know, it helps me out a lot. It really does. You know, and something else that I've learned is that it doesn't matter how many times that we go in and we go in and we go in and we continue to try to carry this message. You know, everybody inside that room that we're carrying the message to, they might not get it right then and there, but the seed's been planted. You know, they know where to come when they're actually ready to get help, and I think that's very important. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Eileen.
Hi.
Very grateful alcoholic. And I came in here looking for ideas. I'm from Houston, but 3.5 years ago, I got sent to Africa. I got sent to Nigeria, and I didn't want to go with my husband. I mean, I wanted to go with my husband, but I didn't want to go to Nigeria. But I knew that pretty quickly that there is no AA in Nigeria. So I knew what I would be doing. It took me a long time to find some two halfway houses, a men's and a woman's, and I'm in Lagos. So I came here looking for ideas. I'm going to the halfway house. I'm not going to the men's. I'm trying to get the two men I know to go to the men's. But I'm going to the women's. They've never heard. These people have never heard of AA. And I'm really touched that I get to do this. And I was sitting here like, what kind of ideas can I take back? And I really, you know, it is sharing from my heart, sharing my story. I'm a high bottom drunk. I came in Al-Anon, and 3 months later, I'm like, okay, something's wrong here. And I stopped drinking at the age of 25. I hadn't done, you know, a whole lot of stuff. So I'm going for these people on the streets. These women are prostituting themselves. They know nothing. Everybody drinks. And one man has said it's the bane of their society, and there are no AA meetings. There is one, this one sober Nigerian man, excuse me, and he's now working with someone else in his village. He comes 4 hours to come to our compound to meet with a couple of guys and me and another woman that are amazingly on our compound of 125 people. We have had 4 alcoholics. Anyway, so I had an idea. Sitting here listening to y'all, I'm going back so soon, I can't go back to Houston and get this going. If anyone would like to write a letter of your story to a extremely poor, uneducated, it's got to be simple language. The big book is too complicated for these people to read. And I can read it, and I can hand it to one woman and say, you read it to them, you know, to the others, and I can hand out pamphlets. And they hang on to them. Now, they're going back out. They're multi-addicted. They don't know other things. But I'm going once a week, you know, with the message. But if anyone wanted to write a letter, I can get letters. I can't get much else. I can get letters and DVDs. But I got up to say, if anybody would want to write some letters that are in very simple language about your experience, especially if you have been in treatment centers. I've never been in a treatment center. I'm a wealthy white woman coming into their to their place. They do hear from my heart, and we do have good conversations. But I would like to, you know, say my address right now. And I can, if you wanted to make a DVD of your story, there is a church. They had to make their own church, this foundation that has started the halfway houses, getting people off the streets. You will not believe the kind of situations these people are in. They had to start a church because the churches wouldn't take these people in. And they felt uncomfortable going to the church. So they started a church. And then when I met the man who started the church, he just about grabbed the big book out of me, my hands, when I explained the 12 steps. I told him what the 12 steps were. He wanted that book. So I'm taking back books. I'm taking back pamphlets. I'm taking back stuff for them in my, you know, the company's shipping it for me. I'll see it in about 4 months. But I get letters in 2 weeks. So what I want to say is, there's people who need our stories, and they need them in very simple language. I could take DVDs. We don't do the internet. There's not power, nor is there money for internet. But I can show them DVDs, and I can take letters. So an address, if anybody would want to do that, is I'm Eileen Meinert, E-I-L-E-E-N. It just touches me so much that God sent me this idea, and it might be of some use to somebody. E-I-L-E-E-N, Meinert, M-E-I-N-E-R-T, P.O. Box 6050, San Ramon, which is S-A-N, and then another word, R-A-M-O-N, California, 94583.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My name is Steve Keen. I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
My sobriety day is April 3, 1979. I'm also a registered nurse, retired. I've also managed a detox unit in a treatment center facility. I've never had any problems separating myself as an alcoholic from my professional life in the alcohol field. What I've always had a problem with, and I've also done past work in Bridging the Gap, which I very, very much believe in and very much encourage. The problem I have found, and discussing this with many people, is I think Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed themselves, you know, we've shot ourselves in the foot. We've turned everything over to the treatment centers. I would challenge and say there's probably, if there was half a dozen people in this room that would know how to go about sobering up a wet drunk, I'd be really surprised. It's a very touchy situation. Now you have the combination if you start throwing drugs in on top of it, and so you have to be very cautious and very careful how the heck you deal with that. But I can tell you right now, if you was to take just a pure heroin addict, throw him into a doggone room and lock the doggone door, you come in there and 5, 6, 7 days later, he's going to be fine. Might not be any paint left on the walls, but he'll be fine. You throw an alcoholic into that same situation, there's a good chance you'll kill him. His heart can go into a rebound effect, and he can just literally blow up. I think the problem we run into is that we have failed miserably to follow the guidelines of our traditions. And that is something I think that has to be done. People who go into these treatment centers, you need to have a good understanding of the traditions. Now, I went through a treatment center for about 31 days, and thank God I did, because it gave me a golden opportunity to sit there for the first time in my life and take a look at myself. Didn't like what I saw. But even that treatment center at that time was very, very entrenched into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I left there with some general instructions, and I left with some personal instructions, but the first thing they told me was to get my butt to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they recommended I start out with 1 to 2 meetings a week and go from there. And they also recommended I get a sponsor. I didn't understand any of this that they told me. But I knew one thing. I had tried to stay sober myself one time. And it hadn't worked. It lasted about 9 months, but didn't, you know. So I was willing to sit there and do what these people suggested to me. At least for a while, until I could get my own feet planted. But the point is we need to sit there and have a good understanding of traditions. We need to sit there and be able to follow those traditions. And I think the treatment centers can do some very, very excellent work in helping us and guiding us. But I think it's up to Alcoholics Anonymous to pick the ball up again and start carrying that ball and helping that suffering alcoholic who's still out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I have a quick show of hands of all those who still want to share? Okay, I see 2 hands. After that, we really do need to close, so thank you. Thank you for your patience, too.
Hi, my name's Don Kay, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska.
Hi, Tom.
I have been a treatment facility chair for the area there, and I can understand what a sparsely populated territory is like. You can actually drive for 9 hours to get to a place. We don't have that much road. If we cut Alaska in half, then both parts would be larger than Texas. So we do have a lot of area. We've got about 300,000 people living in South Central around Anchorage, and we have a lot of people in rural communities. Our definition of remote communities is a bit different than what seems to be common in AA in the continental United States. the perspective is a little different, and we have a lot of committees of one. My point here today is it's real important to keep people alive, and we have a problem with that up north. They die a lot. And a couple of years ago, I got a hold of the treatment facilities desk at the GSO, and I had prepared a little presentation that I used to recruit volunteers in AA and also to educate people involved with treatment centers about what AA treatment facilities are about. I felt I sort of invented the wheel. I sent that to the treatment desk, and I said, can you provide anything to help me out? And Irene, a wonderful lady who's no longer there, said, Don, a year ago I sent out 800 emails to treatment facility people in North America. I got back 5 replies. 4 of them said, we don't have anything for you. I would appreciate it if the folks here who know something about dealing with treatment facilities, dealing with people in treatment facilities, and doing Bridging the Gap, would share it with others so that we can get it. Thank you.
Thank you. One last share, please.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michelle.
My sobriety date is March 5th, 2010, and that's important for a couple reasons. The reason today is because I just graduated with my master's in social work last month, and I want to work primarily with the eating disorder population, but I did my master's thesis on the comorbidity between eating and substance use disorders, and there's extremely high overlap. So I'm going on these interviews because I'm interviewing for jobs in residential treatment facilities for eating disorders, and they're kind of asking me why you want to work in the field, and I didn't even realize that I shouldn't be like, hey, I'm an AA, you know, like I don't even know what to say, you know, when they ask. I can kind of like breeze through an interview, but as far as my career, you know, I'm going to be getting my hours for my license. I'm going to primarily be doing therapy. I don't really know, you know, self-disclosure, how I should do self-disclosure with clients, how I should kind of interact in the workplace with other people, and where I should go to meetings, because there's treatment centers. There's a huge, I live in Newport Beach, California, and there's a huge treatment facility called Sober by the Sea, and they have all their clients come to this Newport, the Solano Club, and that's where I go. And so I don't really know what to do, and I need help because I'm just starting. I really don't want to F this up.
Okay.
So if anybody can help me, that would be great.
Get a good sponsor.
Yeah. And thanks. So thanks. Okay, we need to close.
Okay, if we could just, I bet we can make a circle.